I Eat Green with Bhavani, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green, and I'm here every Wednesday with you from 5 to 6. And it is another beautiful Wednesday. It's so exciting as I drive into the city, and it's not dark anymore. I realize that the days are starting to get longer, and the snow is slowly melting, and soon we'll be able to see the green of our garden again. I can't wait. So, a lot has been going on this week. We were so disappointed with the decision of the United States Department of Agriculture Secretary Vilsack, who approved the deregulation of genetically engineered alfalfa. And, you know, people have said to me, you know, why does that, you know, really affect me? I mean, I don't eat alfalfa sprouts, so I'm really okay. But what they don't realize is that's what cows eat. Our organic cows are eating and grazing in the fields with alfalfa. And so since we can't control the wind and we can't control the bees, it's very likely that the organic fields where these cows graze will be contaminated. And we will lose the right to have organic pure organic milk and organic meat and, you know, whatever it is that you're looking for organic will really be ruined. And so it's really, really important that we all pay attention and we all do our part. And so I'm asking all my listeners to please, you know, send letters, sign petitions, and let's see if we can, you know, shock Washington with hundreds and hundreds of thousands of letters of people against this decision and see if President Obama can reverse this decision, because it's really, really not one that's good for us. The only people it's good for is Monsanto, and that's not good for us. So I beg you all to please do your part. I'm really excited about my show today. I have as my guest Josh Vertel, who is the president of Slow Food USA. And he's been working really hard to get the Slow Food agenda out there for everybody to know about. And we're going to be talking to him later on in the show. And before we get started, I, of course, want to share with you a recipe that I actually just created today, this morning before coming in. I haven't worked with mochi in a while, and I have a couple interns, and one of them was like, okay, well, what do you do with mochi? So I said, let me show you. And I created a Peking mochi recipe. And so I'm going to share that with you. And, you know, I hate calling things mock Peking duck or, you know, something like that, because I don't like to think of it replacing meat. I haven't eaten meat in over 30 years, so I'm not looking to replace meat. But it's, you know, you can use the mochi, you know, it adds a lot of texture, and for those people looking for, you know, more substance, it's similar to seitan in its chewiness. And, you know, it's made from sweet rice. So those of you that don't know, mochi is a Japanese rice cake. It's made from a glutinous rice, which is pounded, and they create a paste out of it, and then it's molded into a shape. And you can fry it or bake it. I choose to bake it, and then once it's baked, you can do many different things with it. So this recipe, I'm going to first tell you the ingredients, and then I'll tell you what to do with everything, okay? You want to start with one 12-ounce package of mochi, and you're going to cut that into 1-inch squares. 1 cup of dried shiitake mushrooms, or an assortment of mushrooms, but dried. 2 carrots, chopped. 1 onion, chopped. 2 teaspoons of chopped garlic. 2 teaspoons of grated ginger. 1/4 cup plus 1 tablespoon of the reserved mushroom water. 1 teaspoon of honey, 3 tablespoons plus 1 tablespoon of tamari, 1.5 teaspoons of organic cornstarch, and you could substitute arrowroot if you'd like, but as long as I'm using organic cornstarch, I don't mind, you know, 1 teaspoon's worth. 1 tablespoon aji marin, 1.5 teaspoons dark sesame oil, 1/4 teaspoon hot sesame oil, or if you don't have that, you can use a couple shakes of red pepper, cayenne pepper, 2 scallions, 1 tablespoon chopped cilantro, also optional if you don't like cilantro, you can easily leave that out and replace it with parsley, 1 cup of baby spinach leaves, 1/2 cup of finely shredded bamboo shoots, and a little olive oil. So you're going to start by baking the mochi at a very high temperature, 450 degrees, on a cookie sheet, and I line it with parchment paper so that I don't have to wash it when I'm finished. And you're going to bake it at 450 degrees for about 8 minutes, and what happens is the mochi will actually puff up and change shapes, you know, takes on its own little shape there, and that's what you want it to do. And then you remove it, and when it cools down, you're going to cut each piece in each of those 1-inch squares into like 4 strips. Okay, then you're going to take the dried mushrooms, place them in a bowl, and cover them with some boiling water and let them sit for 20 minutes. And while that's sitting, take out a large cast iron frying pan, or you could use a wok, and you're going to saute your onion that you're going to slice into slivers, and you're going to saute that for 5 minutes. Then add the chopped carrots and saute for another 3 minutes. Drain the mushrooms and save the soaking water because we're going to use that later on in the recipe. So drain the mushrooms and chop the mushrooms relatively finely and add them to the carrots and the onions. Then add the ginger and the garlic. Stir everything around. Then add the mochi strips and stir that around. And you really want to get the ginger and the garlic covered, you know, all over the mochi. Then add 3 tablespoons of tamari, the mirin, and 1/4 cup of the mushroom broth. In a separate bowl, make a little paste with the cornstarch, the 1 tablespoon of tamari, the honey, and the 1 tablespoon of the mushroom water. And just make a little paste with that, and then add that into the frying pan to the other dish. And then I also will add a handful, it's about 1 cup's worth of baby spinach leaves, and 1 of the small cans of bamboo shoots. Just, you know, chop those little bamboo shoots up, and add those to the frying pan as well. Add the dark sesame oil, the hot sesame oil, and then the scallions. And just cook that for a few minutes on a medium heat. If it's getting very thick from the cornstarch, you can add a little bit extra water, or if you have any extra mushroom broth, you can add that. You want there to be some liquid to it, but the liquid will be thickened from the cornstarch, which is what you're looking for. And then you remove it from the heat and garnish it with the cilantro, with the 1 tablespoon of chopped cilantro. If you don't like cilantro, you can certainly use parsley instead. But this is great. This recipe, I mean, it looks like something that I haven't eaten in years from the Chinese restaurant. And it's delicious. And you can serve it over udon noodles, or you can actually also serve it with a softened tortilla, you know, and roll it up with some plum ginger sauce, you know, kind of like a Peking duck would be. Or you can roll it in a rice paper skin, you know, kind of like a spring roll. So there's lots of different ways that you can serve this, you know, let your creativity go and have fun with it. But it's delicious, and I think you'll really enjoy it. So now I would like to invite Josh on to join us.
Hello.
Hi, Josh. How are you?
Well, how are you doing?
Good. I'm so glad you can join us. How are you feeling? I know you weren't feeling well last week.
Yeah, I've been traveling a little bit too much, and I got a cold. It's great to be on the show, though. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So Slow Food has been involved in a lot of stuff recently, as always. And You know, for those that don't know slow food, most of my listeners do because as a slow food chapter leader, I'm always talking about slow food. But in your words, why don't you just briefly tell everybody what slow food is in case they don't know?
Great. So slow food, at its most basic, is just an antidote to fast food. It's food that's good for the people who eat it, it's good for the people who grow it, and it's good for the planet. It's food that's good, clean, and fair. And Slow Food, the organization, is working to make a world where everyone can eat good, clean, and fair food. And we're doing it really by empowering everyday people to bring integrity to the way food is grown and shared in their communities. We support folks all over the country who are doing that work, who are doing the kind of work that you're doing.
Right. And one of the reasons I am so attracted to Slow Food is because it is a grassroots movement, and it's about enjoying food and really cooking real food. And that's what I feel like is not done enough in our society. I mean, even when people invite people over to eat, usually they're bringing in food from somewhere. I mean, people have forgotten about cooking food and the joy that that is. I mean, for me, when I have people over, I invite them over and we cook together. You know, it's a social activity. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I think Slow Food is so good about, is promoting the actual cooking and, you know, and enjoying the food together.
It's such a powerful common experience. My parents chose to raise me up on the floor of their kitchen, and that's where I grew up as a little kid. And for me, that vegetable steamer, you know, the one that opens and closes,
right,
like a camera lens,
mm-hmm,
that was like my favorite toy as a little kid. I'd put little Lego men in there and fly it off. And so for me, being in that kitchen was childhood, and that was family. And we always gathered around the table for dinner. Around the table was where I learned everything that matters. It was where I learned to share. It was where I learned to think critically. It was where I learned to disagree with people and
mm-hmm
to love them,
mm-hmm,
which is such an important skill. And I see on some level what we're trying to do is to bring that common experience, that way that you see what you have in common with people before you see what you have in difference when you share food with them,
mm-hmm,
to bring that back so that people can have those kinds of relationships that you can only develop when you share real food or when you share real work.
Right. I agree with you. Now, I know one of the main focuses of Slow Food over the last year has been the Time for Lunch campaign.
Hmm.
And, it really culminated last Labor Day when we celebrated the Time for Lunch picnic. And we had hundreds of picnics all across the country, all on the same day. And that was to raise awareness for the reauthorization of the Child Nutrition Act. Now that that is, you know, has been voted on, and it was a little disappointing, I must say, we didn't get as much extra money as, you know, the school lunch program certainly needs. We did get a little. Is that still a focus for Slow Food, or are we moving on to, you know, some other focus?
No, it's absolutely still a focus. And that day and that campaign, which lasted over a year, I think was a really important turning point in the life of the food movement. There were over 307 events all over the country. More than 20,000 people were part of them. There were events in every state. And it was a change in the way that folks do advocacy, I think. Instead of just being strident activists, we were having a potluck protest, these eat-ins all over the country. And that then built the kind of community that later could take action and push legislators for better policy. And, you know, we didn't get everything we wanted, but I have to say it was really a transformational bill. I mean, we got the largest increase in the 60-year history of the bill, the first time there was any real increase above inflation. We got $40 million mandatory funding to set up farm-to-school programs and gardens in public schools. And we gave the USDA the authority to hold all the food served in schools to some nutritional standard. So for the first time, there's a sort of vehicle for kicking junk food out of schools and making sure that all the food served there is good for kids. And that's the first time that's ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so some incredible things happen with that bill. The next step is all the on-the-ground work that I think all of us have to do in our districts, making sure that school lunch actually changes where our kids are going to school. And that's local work with your school principal, with the nutrition director, helping them see how to get real local sustainable food into the food service. And then it's also us watching as citizens as the USDA figures out how to implement this new law and making sure that the standards they choose are good ones. And so we've got a lot of work to do locally, but we also have a lot of work to do nationally as we push to make sure the law is implemented well. And I see everywhere I go, people are doing this work so creatively. I was just in Denver, and before that I was in Indianapolis. And in Denver, they have 50 gardens in 50 different public schools. So 50 of the 85 schools in that city have gardens in them where the kids are growing and eating food. They're training all the dining service workers to buy local sustainable food and cook from scratch. And it's all based on the power of local volunteers who are part of the Slo Food Network doing it. And I'm completely moved to see the power of a parent who gets upset and sees that things should be different than they are and gets engaged. I really see our work more than anything else as supporting people as they do that.
Right, trying to mobilize people to take on what they're passionate about and support them in that.
It's incredible what they do if they're supported.
Uh-huh.
And if they're part of a bigger community, which I think is one of the strengths of Slo Food, is once you're part of Slo Food's work, you find the people who share your values in your community and you find them on a national scale and you become part of something bigger than any one individual.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful what can be accomplished.
Right. Well, one thing that Slo Food did to become so much more accessible to everybody, I really love that we lowered the membership rate so that it's really affordable for just about everybody.
That was so important to me because I really feel like everyone should be able to be a part of this work and to feel like they're a part of the Slo Food community.
Mm-hmm.
And now we did drop it from $60 down to $25.
Right.
And you know, my hope is even for someone who maybe can't afford the $25, that there's a way to get involved at the local level.
Absolutely. We send our email list to everybody, whether they're a member or not, and they're welcome to everything.
It's the right way to do it because, mm-hmm. you know, being engaged financially is really important, and it makes it possible for us to do this work nationally and internationally. But even more important than that is just being able to have an outlet for a little bit of time if you want to help get involved or get educated, and Slo Food needs to be that.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Slo Food doing anything particular to try to mobilize people to reverse the decision on the GE alfalfa?
It's a great question. We actually just signed on to a letter with an organization that we're very close with called Food Democracy Now that everyone
mm-hmm.
should absolutely check out. And Food Democracy Now right now is sort of taking the lead on that fight, and we're playing a supportive role. But we're looking at ways in which we can use our network and all the people we have nationally to push for better food policy across the board. We're looking at the next Food and Farm Bill, which will be up for reauthorization in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Such an important opportunity. That one piece of legislation really determines the face of agriculture in America and even globally, and it's important that we mobilize folks to change it. So, yes, we're part of that struggle, and we'll be part of future struggles, too.
I know very often people ask me, well, how does the Farm Bill affect me? I'm not a farmer. You want to share with people that misnomer, and how does the Farm Bill affect every one of us?
Well, it's really not just a Farm Bill. That's what it's called, but I see it as the Food and Farm Bill. It determines how all of agriculture works in this country. It subsidizes with about $25 billion of your taxpayer money and mine every year the crops that are worse for our health and worse for the environment. It makes foods that are bad for us cheap and doesn't do anything to lower the cost of the foods that are good for us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all because of this piece of legislation, which has really become the plaything of agribusiness, something that agribusiness has invented and kept as it is, to the disservice of American farmers and to the detriment of American eaters and our environment. We have this very expensive piece of legislation in a time of growing deficits that's terrible for the environment, terrible for us, but really good for a few corporations. And we need to turn it around.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the price of fruits and vegetables over the last 20 years, they've gone up dramatically. And if you look at the price of soda and chips, they've dropped dramatically.
Right.
And that is essentially the product of the industrial food system taking over our federal legislation. And I think that citizens and farmers need to take it back.
Right. And so it's all the subsidized, you know, ingredients that go into that fast food. I know you got to ask the president on the interview on YouTube, you know, why are Fruit Loops cheaper to feed our kids than real fruit?
Yes.
What did you think of his response?
That's a good question. His response leaned very heavily on some work that he and the First Lady have done with Walmart in the last few months. And some people, I think, are excited about Walmart's new labeling schemes and them potentially buying more healthy, sustainable food. And some people are not. And I'm, rather than get into that debate, I think the real issue is that the president, in this interview, on this one issue, only on food and farming, outsourced all of his thinking and all of his initiative to a major consolidated corporation. And it's a strange thing to watch your president say this issue that touches all of us, that thousands of people voted to make me answer. I'm gonna hand over responsibility to Walmart. It would be like watching him hand over responsibility to BP on a question about offshore drilling, because at core, Walmart is a core cause of what's wrong with food and farming
right.
in this country.
Right.
And so I was really disappointed. But at the same time, you know, I heard him very early on in his presidency say that he agrees with all of our issues, but if we're going to get him to do anything about it, we've got to make him do it. And for me, this was a reminder that the responsibility is back on us.
Mm-hmm.
And that when it comes to transforming food and farming in this country, the people who voted for that question on YouTube are ultimately going to be much more important than the person who answered it. It's really our responsibility, and we have to take that forward. The leadership has to come from us.
Right. Well, you know, that's one thing that I always am perplexed about as to why there's such apathy in our society. You know, there's so many issues that need people to rally around, this being one of them, and we're not rising to the occasion, you know. And Slow Food's doing a great job, but we need to like triple, like you said. You know, we have, I don't know how many members we have right now, but we want to have over 1 million, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we really need to get the numbers up, and we certainly have the numbers in this country. And, you know, the fact that these companies like Nestle can make the same product for the European market without genetically engineered ingredients, but for us, they make them with genetically engineered ingredients, it just shows you that it's possible. They do it for, you know, the European market, but because they won't allow the genetically engineered foods. Their government is more sympathetic to the health of their people, I guess, than our government is. And,
well, you know, I would say that their citizens won't stand for some of these things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Mark Bittman said in an interview the other day, I thought this was a great thing to say, you know, if this is a democracy, let's run it. And if it's not, let's change it.
Right.
Like, and I really think that we have a responsibility to push hard for laws that make sense for us. And one thing I will say is there's certainly potential for more engagement, but I've seen when we create a pathway for a concerned Michael Pollan reader to do something about it, or a mom who's just dropped her kid off at school for the first day and wonders what their child is going to eat, to do something about it, we see our numbers swell. And I think there are so many people in this country who are really ready to change the way food and farming work, and they're concerned and they're looking for an outlet and some way to make it right. And that Slow Food is that outlet. And when we present ourselves in that way, we see so many people come in and say, we want to be a part of this solution. We have something to offer. For me, that gives me incredible hope, because it's power based on everyday people ready to roll up their sleeves and do something about it in their community or on a national scale. And I think that's what it's going to take.
Yeah. I agree with you on that one. Back to the Slow Food in School, you know, with the Time for Lunch campaign, the Slow Food in School program.
Mm-hmm.
I've also been hearing about a food court program. Now, is the Slow Food in School program connected to this food court program that I've been hearing about?
It is very connected, and we actually have one of our fantastic staff members on the, in the programs department is working. Part of her time is devoted to Food Corps. And so Food Corps is a new program that is, it's almost like Teach for America. It's an AmeriCorps program, but it's particularly to get young people just out of college working in the public school system to set up farm-to-school programs, so the schools are buying local food, or setting up and teaching in school gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And what it pays young people a small stipend, it gives them health insurance, excuse me, and job training, and positions them to transform these young people's relationship to food. It's a fantastic program, and if there's a young person out there graduating from college who wants to get involved in this movement, Food Corps is actually now taking applications for AmeriCorps positions to get placed in public schools and to help with gardens and local purchasing all over the country. It's really a fantastic new program.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. Now, was that set up by someone from the Food and Society Fellows Program? Do you know who out of that?
Kurt Ellis is one of the founders of Food Corps, and he's also one of the filmmakers who made the wonderful movie King Corn.
Uh-huh.
And Kurt's on our board, actually, and is an old friend. And it's Food Corps is in part his baby, but it's also Deb Eschemeyer, who does great work with the Farm to School program, and Cecily Upton, who used to work at Slow Food, and also Jerusha, who I mentioned, who works at Slow Food. So it's a big family of people who've been cooking up this idea for a long time, and I think it's really an idea whose time has come.
Yeah, it's very exciting. I know I've signed up to be a part of the Chef's Move to Schools, you know, Michelle Obama's initiative. So I'm working with a few schools on Long Island trying to take a look at their school lunch program as well.
That's so great. I mean, imagine what it would look like if in our country, when you graduated from college, a really normal thing to do would be to go and teach kids about gardening.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be at a public school where there's a local chef who's there to help you, like you might be, and that you can reach so many kids in this way. You know, Slow Food this last year reached over 62,000 children with their gardens that they've set up in schools all over the country. And that's just with the power of volunteers without any formal program. It's something we support our chapter leaders in establishing, and it's so impactful. And you imagine the potential power as you grow that out, and it's really astounding.
Mm-hmm. Another program that Slow Food has that I love is the Arc of Taste.
Mm.
And when I was in Italy at Terra Madre, you know, there was a lot of tables set up about the presidias and the, preserving the biodiversity in our crops and really being a strong supporter of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when I was at the NOFA conference just a few weeks ago, I met the people from RAFT, Renewing America's Food Traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Slow Food was working with RAFT at one point. And then they said, when I was asking them, you know, whether anybody from Slow Food was there, they said no, that Slow Food's not really involved in that anymore. What's going on with that?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Well, you know, all of the RAFT partners are still doing work related to biodiversity, and it's core to these organizations' mission, and to Slow Foods as well. And that's the American Livestock Breed Conservancy, which is a great organization. Chefs Collaborative, also fantastic.
Great organization.
Gary Paul Nabhan, who's real, almost sort of a Johnny Appleseed for biodiversity in the U.S. right now, and then Slow Food. So RAFT has been a partnership for years, and this last year, all the partners together sort of got to a point where they realized we've been working together for a long time, we're sort of all growing as organizations, and a formal alliance, it maybe doesn't make sense anymore. And we had hit the end of a funding cycle, we didn't really have clarity about a set of common goals we'd all work towards and what each of our roles would be, so we all made the decision to dissolve the formal alliance, but to leave it open that we would work together, and my hope and plan is to have us keep on working together in informal ways to promote our various work preserving biodiversity. And so for us, particularly, when we look at biodiversity projects in the food system, it's always got to be based on the power of everyday people seeing a way to fix the problem. And so I think about like Paula Shatkin. Paula in Northern California, moved to a community and started to see all of these old apple orchards cut down and the Gravenstein apple disappearing. And Paula rolled up her sleeves and said, I want to start organizing apple growers to keep these apples from being lost to industrial wine and also to development. And so she began organizing these growers and having them sell cooperatively and really promoting the brand of this apple variety, which was at risk of being lost, the Gravenstein. And watching her work in Northern California has really been so inspiring for all of us, because here's this person who, she's not really a horticulturalist, she doesn't really have a background in this, but she saw something going wrong in her community when it came to biodiversity and when it came to food systems, and she just decided to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And so Slow Food is looking for ways all over the country where we can keep on supporting people as they do that work. And we've seen it all over. I mean, incredible work happening with apples in the Northeast, as well as in California. The Navajo Churro sheep, which is this fantastic sheep variety that was at risk, is now in much stronger shape, in part because of Slow Food chapter leaders and volunteers who really promoted it, introduced it to chefs, and made it something that people in a region where it's native, that they might look for it. So that's the kind of work that we want to keep on doing, and we're looking for ways of growing it out even more on a national scale.
Mm-hmm. So the decision to not be aligned with Raft was kind of a mutual decision from both sides?
Yeah, so at this point the partnership is formally dissolved. All the partners decided that together.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Slow Food is really supportive of all the other organizations' work, and I'm sure we're going to find ways to keep on working together. But a formal alliance is, in my mind, always best when it's focused on achieving a specific goal and where each partner has a specific role to play.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through a period of time where that was true with the Raft Alliance. And this is very natural with alliances. They grow and they change. Goals are met. Organizations change. We hit a point where it just wasn't really the case anymore. And where I think funders also began to realize that this had a sort of useful life, and it was time for each organization and Gary as an individual to grow in their own separate ways, but we'll keep on working together.
Mm-hmm. But Raft, that has nothing to do with the Arc of Taste and the Presidias that we're funding around the world.
That they're
those are separate.
Totally unrelated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, they're related in that the purpose of all of them is to, at core, to promote biodiversity in the food system.
Mm-hmm.
Really more than anything else, as an alternative to the industrial system. You know, we're talking about huge systemic change in the way we grow and share food. And when you talk about what's so wrong, there are so many groups talking about how broken things are around climate, around food justice, and being able to paint a picture of a world in which food and farming play a positive role is just vital. And that's true across everything that's wrong. We need to find a way to paint a different picture of every way we can do this right. And our biodiversity work is vital in that way, in that it says, look, there's an alternative to a monocrop. There's an alternative to an agriculture that is against nature. We can do this. We can grow food for each other in a way that increases biodiversity, increases ecosystem health, and we can feed each other with it. And so our biodiversity work is vital just in inspiring people with that alternative.
Yeah, well, also as a chef, you know, how many times do we see these beautiful vegetables and then you taste them and there's no flavor? You know,
absolutely.
And, you know, the Arc of Taste is all about taste. And so often people don't even realize. I mean, people get these... Sorry, I lost my mic for a minute. People, you know, look at these beautiful strawberries and it's almost like people are not even aware that they're not tasting. They take a big, beautiful red strawberry and they go, so good. And then I taste one. I'm going, no, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
There's no flavor there. Here.
It's water and chemical fertilizer.
Right. This doesn't taste like a strawberry. There's no. There's like a tartness, but there's no flavor of strawberry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that happens over and over with different things that I taste. And then when I taste something that I've gotten out of my garden or from a farmer's market, and you taste the strawberry, it's like, oh, there's the flavor.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm looking for. And
mm-hmm.
and it's almost like people are so used to not having the flavor, they don't even notice that there's no flavor there.
It's so right. And, you know, I used to be a vegetable grower, and that experience of watching, particularly kids get it immediately. They're right there. And they taste a real strawberry. especially a young kid who hasn't before, they'll just laugh. It's like they've never tasted anything so beautiful or so real before. When they pull a carrot up from the ground and you wash it off and they taste it,
right?
Or they pick their own tomatoes, and they're still warm from the sun. Mm-hmm. It just changes their minds, and they see there's something right about this.
Yeah, I have a peach tree, and you know, I just can't. I live for the summer when I can pick those peaches because, you know, for years, peaches I used to love as a kid. You know, you take a bite and they drip down your arm and they're juicy.
Oh.
And they're, you know, they're just unbelievable. And then they just stopped being that way.
Mm-hmm.
They were either hard or they're gritty or they just weren't good. And now I have a peach tree where they're, you know, the memory I had of peach. And it speaks to peach, and it's just, you know, they might not be beautiful, there might be a bruise that I have to cut out or what, but it is just, the flavor, you can't compare. And so, you know, very often when I'm talking to people, I ask them to really pay attention to the taste. If you get a tomato, it might look beautiful, but if there's no flavor there, it's not worth buying, you know, it's not worth eating. So.
Beauty has a whole different meaning when you really learn the story behind something.
Yeah.
And I think the story behind food is that way. And when there's a story behind it that's not industrial, and there's a story behind it that has real handwork in it, and that has a link to the weather, and has a link to really fertile soil that's well taken care of, you taste it in the food.
Yeah.
And it's a story you can be proud of. And you can't taste that with industrial food. It's not there. The story behind it is one that would make you ashamed to tell. And when you taste food that has a story behind it that would make you proud, that really shows up in the flavor. And we're lucky because, you know, so many social movements, and when you push to do the right thing, you have to suffer. And I think in the food movement, doing the right thing is delicious.
Right.
And it's just a beautiful thing. And that power of pleasure is not divorced from responsibility, actually. We're in this wonderful place where pleasure and responsibility are like the flip side of the same coin. We have this myth in our country that pleasure is gluttony and responsibility is drudgery. And slow food says, no. The deepest pleasure comes from fulfilling real responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, people go to Italy and they say, you know, they come back and they go, the food is so great. And it's because they're starting with food that was grown
well.
Well.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And it makes all the difference. Anyway, hold for a minute. We're going to take just a couple-minute break, Josh, and then we'll be back. And when we come back, I really would like to talk about some of the other programs that Slow Food's doing, like the sale of approval, that's really big, and a few other things, okay?
Great. Excellent.
Thanks.
You are listening to PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Adam Kolker from the Brooklyn Jazz Underground. We're going to be hosting a weekly show every Tuesday at 5 p.m., focusing on sounds coming from the borough of Brooklyn. We'll be playing some new releases, doing live interviews, some live performances, maybe even venture out into music from some of the outer boroughs. Brooklyn Jazz Underground, Tuesday at 5, only on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you a conscious college student? If you're interested in progressive news and politics, we want to hear from you. The Progressive Radio Network is looking for radio hosts to discuss college life and the issues dealing with being in a university. Send an email to karalee@garynoel.com, K-A-R-A-L-E-E at garynoel.com, or call 646-307-4482 and tell me your radio experience and any idea you could contribute to PRN.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest today is Josh Fattell, the president of Slow Food USA. And I'm really so happy to have him here. As most of you know, I am a co-chair of our local Slow Food chapter, Slow Food Huntington. And so Slow Food's very close to my heart, and I'm really thrilled that Josh is with us today. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Bhavani. It's great to be here.
Thank you. So one of the things that I, you know, some of my listeners had asked me to ask you was about the Snail of Approval program. And I know we were talking a little bit, and you said it's not, it's really more of a pilot program than a really, you know, full-blown program of Slow Food. But, you know, so for people that don't know, what Snail of Approval is supposed to be is, you know, a restaurant that's meeting a certain set criteria that Slow Food has set up. Is there actually a criteria that we're asking these restaurants to meet?
So the Snail of Approval was set up by Slow Food in New York City, and it's a pilot project. It's really just happening there, and it's feeling out what it might look like to have the local volunteer leadership and membership identify restaurants that reflect Slow Food's values. And so there's a small committee that vets nominations, and if they feel that the restaurant's meeting the standards and values of Slow Food, they give them a little decal they can put in their window.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the great things about it is restaurants love to be associated with Slow Food, and I think customers really want to know where they can eat food that reflects their values.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really exciting. And one of the things I'd love to see going forward, and we're actually designing this as we go, is the possibility for the average consumer, the member, any person to hop online and say, hey, here's a place that really reflects my values, and then to have other folks hop on and say, no, actually, that's not quite right, or yes, I really love that place. And so to have it really be a crowdsourced thing rather than...
So it could be more like a Yelp or a Chowhound for Slow Foodies.
But really for good, clean, fair food.
Right, right.
Yeah, and so we're just feeling out what that might look like and how that might relate to the Snail of Approval. But it's pretty early on and figuring that out. You know, like so many of Slow Food's programs, though, it's really based on the power of local volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
And the Snail of Approval right now is that way. And so I think they do a pretty good job in New York. And I know that folks definitely look out for that brand when they're looking for a restaurant that reflects their values.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I mean, if a restaurant has a Snail of Approval, but somebody eats there and doesn't feel like it should meet the standard, or they feel like, you know, some of the workers might not be treated well. Do they have a place that they can go to kind of report back to Slow Food USA to say we should maybe reevaluate that?
Well, I wouldn't, because Slow Food USA as a national organization hasn't really endorsed the restaurant. The local chapter has. I would go to the local chapter. And I would say, hey, you guys endorsed, as a local chapter, you endorsed this restaurant, and it didn't reflect my values. Or on the reverse, there's this fantastic place that just opened that that really reflects our values, and that serves good, clean, fair food. It's locally sourced, and workers are treated well. And I think that Slow Food should consider them for this nail of approval.
Mm-hmm.
And this, again, is just Slow Food New York City where this project is being piloted. That's what I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure they'd be open to listening to it.
That's a good suggestion. Great. Because I know Ann and I have had members say that they would love us to point out different restaurants on Long Island, as you know, that would meet the criteria. But we didn't know if there's really even a list of criteria. We just go by our own gut of what we know Slow Food is supposed to be, and take it from there.
Well, you know, I think it's a really good idea, and I think that we can work with folks who lead chapters all over the country. And really, I believe those criteria should come from the people who are putting their time and energy into building this movement on the ground. You all have a very strong sense of what's right, and let's develop some rough criterion together. But then let's let all of the people in our network, you know, we reach over 300,000 people now, let them start identifying places that they feel reflect their values, and over time maybe we can sort of paint a picture of a Slow Food Nation, restaurants and farmers markets, CSAs all over the country that really reflect that.
Great. Well, another question I have is, as a a Slow Food fan, personally, you know, many people who know that I'm a vegetarian and don't eat meat, they've asked me, how can I be a member of Slow Food when, you know, a lot of what Slow Food is about is, you know, helping to promote heritage breeds, as, you know, when we come to biodiversity, as well as, you know, biodiversity in vegetables and fruits. You know, and I'm very comfortable with that, because I feel like it is everyone's choice. And if I'm going to promote, you know, I know that it's not realistic that everyone's going to stop eating meat on the planet. So if I'm going to be a part of something, I want it to be something that's sustainable, and I want people to be making choices to eat healthier meat that's raised in a sustainable way. But now that it's, you know, really out there that, you know, that the raising of meat is so detrimental to the planet, you know, as we go greener, and also as when we look at diets, you know, the recommendation, which is a no-brainer, has come out that we should eat more fruits and vegetables and less of the meat. Is Slow Food, as a political advocacy organization, trying to slant a little bit their view to try to encourage people to eat more plant-based meals? You know, not get necessarily give up meat, but, you know, become more flexitarian, as the new lingo is, you know, being put out there.
I mean, I think Michael Pollan said it best when he said, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. I think that's a great and simple recipe for how to eat sustainably and in a way that will be healthy. I think that there are ways of growing meat that are not just less environmentally damaging, but are actually, from an ecosystem perspective, can repair damage. And, you know, I've seen incredible and worked on incredible grass-based meat production systems that are so well integrated to the landscape. And that meat, I believe, particularly in those landscapes where cultivation in hilly spots would lead to erosion, that meat is actually a really sustainable way of feeding oneself in those environments. But the vast majority of meat in this country is grown in a way that is terrible for the environment, and that's also terrible for us. And so I think that there's two things going on here. One is we absolutely should not be eating factory-farmed meat. It's terrible for the environment. It's terrible for the animals. It's terrible for the workers. And it's terrible for us. Then there's this other thing going on, which is given that we all need to just remove that from our diet, which to me is just a no-brainer, well, then we have a choice. We can either say we're not going to have any meat, which some people do, and I think that's great, or we can say we're going to have meat that reflects our values, ideally in moderation. And I think that that's a choice that is between two good options.
Mm-hmm.
And I really leave that up to everybody. I eat meat, but I make a point of knowing where it's from, knowing the grower, knowing it was raised in a way that really I can stand behind.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel good about that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But I also am really close friends with vegetarians, and when they come over, I know how to cook a great vegetarian meal, and I don't eat meat every week by any means. So it's really the first thing is don't eat factory farm meat. It doesn't reflect anyone's values. No one could stand behind that. And the second thing is choose between eating meat that does reflect your values and not eating any, and both of those are good choices.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, because also when we're trying to promote food in schools, the reality is, right now anyway, none of the schools have money to buy meat that would reflect those values.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, trying to encourage schools to do more and more plant-based meals seems like the only sane thing, because, you know, there's no way that... I mean, part of the problem is that the USDA is trying to do two things. They're trying to, you know, promote their product, and at the same time they're trying to, you know, help us, you know, put healthy school food on the agenda. And they can't be done because they're, you know, they're saying, well, you have to take the subsidized food that we're giving you, the commodity food, or, you know, you're cut from the program. But the food that they're giving you is not the food that we want the kids to be eating. Any suggestions?
Well, there's a lot going on in there. One thing is, I think it's possible for the public school system to serve some meat that reflects our values. I think that I did this at Yale University, actually, which has more flexibility in terms of budget, but less than you'd think. We worked with a cooperative of grass-based beef growers, and they were making all of their money with high-end cuts, and we were able to get a tremendously good deal on beef for grinding for hamburgers from them. It was delicious. Students loved it. It was so much better than the industrial beef we were getting before. The cost increase was moderate, and we were able to help those growers be more financially stable because this product that they couldn't move now had an outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if we were able to increase small-scale and mid-sized livestock processing, so slaughterhouses and places to break down and process meat, and give farmers access to that, if we were able to reduce some of the regulatory barriers for small and mid-sized growers, make it possible for them to be financially successful, and then we had schools as an institutional outlet for the cuts of meat that aren't filet mignon, I think that you'd actually see that there's quite a bit you can do, particularly if meat isn't the center of the plate always.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jefferson talked about meat essentially as a garnish, right? And so we don't need to have a massive steak or a massive hamburger at every lunch, but some pasta with some ground beef in the sauce, or a hamburger for kids once a week, not every day, but grown from meat that we really believe in, that could be a great way to power the local farm economy. These processing facilities could power the local rural economy, and we'd also be feeding kids food that's healthy, and it would be integrated into a diet that is much more that's much more plant-based
mm-hmm.
than meat-based, but there's still a place for it, I think, and it's possible. Then, talking about the USDA, I think you're absolutely right. They have this dual purpose that makes no sense, where on the one hand they're trying to find an outlet for the byproducts, the waste products, and the overproduction of an industrial agricultural system,
mm-hmm.
and then they're trying to feed our kids.
Right.
And those two things don't go well together.
No, they don't.
And we need to separate them out. I spoke with my friend Robbie Kenner, who produced the movie Food, Inc.,
mm-hmm.
and while he was gathering footage, and he said, you know, the worst images, the most disturbing images that we've gathered of our industrial food system all were of food that was heading to the National School Lunch Program. So if you saw that movie, you remember there's some really upsetting images of how industrial food works.
We actually had a screening of that last night, so it's very fresh in my mind.
The worst of the worst was going to feed your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Was going to feed your kids, and that's why we have to change it.
Yeah. Well, Josh, we're starting to come to the end of the show, so I don't want to run out of time without giving everybody some information as to what they can do and where they can go to get involved.
So I would say there's three ways to get involved, and all of them are vital if we're going to change the way food and farming works in this country. The first is just as an individual. Eat food that reflects your values. Share it with your kids. Cook together. Bring your community together around food. Have the decisions you make about food be ones that you can really stand behind. That's vital. But it's not enough, because not everyone can afford to do that. And because there are big structural barriers to a good, clean, fair food system, we need to begin to address them. So then the second way that we can get engaged is through projects in our community. I mean, I have seen folks, parents, teachers, farmers, college students, start the most incredible transformational projects in their communities, from gardens in public schools. One single working mom in Southern California has gotten 24 different schools to start gardens in her community.
Mm-hmm.
Just the power of this individual. So gardens in public schools, potluck events, monthly dinner gatherings, or setting up farmers markets in low-income neighborhoods. All of these local community projects and slow food chapters are really an outlet for how you can get involved in creating those projects on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So do work in your community, do work as an individual, but then also get engaged nationally. And slow food is there to help you do that, actually. There's going to be this incredibly important struggle around the next food and farm bill. Be a part of it. Be a part of it with the way you vote, you eat. Be a part of it with the way you're engaged with your community. But also, contact your legislator and tell them what you think. Tell them what you feel like your kids deserve as policy.
Mm-hmm.
And slow food will be there to help essentially provide a pathway for you to do that. You can hop online at slowfoodusa.org, and hop on our mailing list. And we'll be giving you outlets for ways that you can get involved. Lately, that mailing list collectively voted to get that president, to get that question in front of our president,
mm-hmm.
Why are Fruit Loops cheaper than fruit? And so if you want to be a part of that kind of a struggle, that's the same group that pushed for the incredible transformation that we've seen in school lunch policy. Still
mm-hmm.
more to be done, but that group is there for that. So hop online, sign up for that mailing list, and get engaged in the national fight. Join your local slow food chapter, get engaged in the community, and then vote with your fork.
Thank you. Perfect. Perfect timing. So everybody, you heard Josh. Please go to slowfoodusa.org. Sign up to get involved and enjoy your food and make wise choices. Thank you, Josh. And I'll be speaking to you soon. And everybody,
thank you so much.
Have a wonderful rest of your week. And I'll see you next week. God bless.